I don't know what it is about human nature. It's a funny, funny thing. But whenever we do something a little bit out of the ordinary, and it's us that has to do it, it's a cause for us to get a little bit nervous. I'm accustomed to standing up and leading this part of the service, so I rarely get nervous at this time. But a minute ago, when I gave the announcement, I was nervous. I don't understand it. So I don't feel nervous now. I was nervous then. That's just human nature. And I don't know if you're feeling like I am this morning, but with the beautiful weather outside, I wish we were back at the picnic today. But we'll take another 45 minutes and then we'll be out. Got a little bit of an echo there. I want to address Halloween this morning. I had intended to pick up with a series of teachings I've been doing on the subject of sin, and believe it or not, I'm not done yet. And I do intend to actually spend 3 or 4 more weeks on that topic. But someone had called me this week and asked if I could please address the Halloween issue, so I would like to respond to that and do that this morning. How many of you know, I'd like to start with this, how many of you know that Halloween is a Christian holiday? It's a Christian holiday. Now, does that necessarily mean, therefore, that since it's a Christian holiday, which I'll explain all of that as we go on today, that we should, therefore, celebrate it? And the answer is, not necessarily. I'm not going to tell you during the course of what I'm going to talk about here exactly what you should do or shouldn't do in regards to Halloween. I know it would be easy for me, and you might imagine that if I'm going to talk to you about Halloween, you know, I would probably be here to try and talk you out of some level of participation in Halloween. But I'm not going to try and talk you out of participating in Halloween this morning. What I hope to do is to inform you so that each and every one of you as an individual and each and every one of you as a household can make an informed, discerning decision, not just for whatever you might have planned for this evening, but for all of the years ahead when this date rolls around in the calendar, and beyond that, so that you're a little bit better equipped, hopefully, to face and to deal with the kinds of issues that Halloween represents to us in our culture. Okay? So let's talk about it just a little bit. Halloween, I don't know about you, but growing up, Halloween for me basically meant two things. And it probably is the same for you. Halloween meant a chance to dress up. One of my earliest memories was when I was probably 4 years old. I might have been 5 years old. I don't do real good on long distant past memories. I have got a great memory for certain things, and then there are other things that just kind of fade out, and if you told me this was your life story, I wouldn't even know it. But I have this one memory of I must have been 4 or 5 years old, and my mom allowed me to dress up as my ultimate hero, which was Superman at that time. And I had a blue shirt with the Superman emblem on it, and the little red trunks, if you can imagine, and I had a cape and the whole thing. And I'm telling you, I lived on the strength of that night for months after that, because she got me some of those old rain boots that you used to get, those old red vinyl rain boots. Oh man, I was Superman that night. And, the whole thing. I was there. And, because I used to watch Superman on TV all the time I don't think I ever missed an episode. And so, this was my one chance, obviously, in my own little heart and mind to be Superman. And that's what Halloween was about to me at that age and growing up. It wasn't about, goblins and ghosts and things like that. It was an opportunity to dress up as something that was important to me. And then, of course, the bigger thing beyond that was what? Candy, yeah. And in the old days, and I'm speaking of, my childhood as the old days, we used to do things like, we weren't satisfied with these little weenie little candy bags that they use nowadays. We would get, a pillowcase. A big pillowcase, because there's the little ones and the big ones, We would get a big pillowcase, and we would go out, and we would just fill that thing until we couldn't carry it. And then it wasn't like, okay, I'm satisfied, I'm done. We would run home and empty it out, and we'd go out for another run. And in those days, you could do that, because everyone participated at that level. And it was just, it seemed to me, to my perspective at that time, to be good, clean fun and a way to just really score a lot of candy for free. And we did that. And I don't think, honestly looking back, I don't think I was harmed or, you know, I was raised by unbelieving parents. We didn't, you know, there was no Christian perspective that was involved in this for us growing up. But I don't think I was harmed by that. I don't think I was marked by that. I don't think I was scarred by that spiritually. I don't think by going out and going door to door, I don't think any demons jumped inside of me. I think I was able to, you know, go through that whole experience and just experience it for what it was and see it for what it was. Now, unfortunately, some things have changed in our society since that time. It was, I think you would all agree readily, it was a more innocent time. I'm talking about, if I was 4 or 5, it must have been like 1960, because I was born in 55, so it must have been around that range. And it was a more innocent time. It was a quieter time. It was a time that there was more of a community awareness. There was more of a care and concern for the children of the community that was shared by all the people that lived in our community. And there was, people, neighbors would watch out for one another and for one another's children and those kind of things. And things have somewhat changed. And Halloween now is not so much in our culture, in our society, just good, clean fun anymore. I think there still is some good, clean fun that's attached to it. But there are other elements that are added to it. And there seems to be much more of a glorification of darkness and of the things of evil. There, you know, it's just a contrast with Superman for me versus Jason in Halloween part, 182 in the movies. You know what I'm saying? And it's all about slashers and blood and gore and vampires and, you know, just anything that would tend to be of darkness is glorified and it's given justification as though, you know, for this one brief moment of the year, it's all right for everybody to kind of like that stuff. And, of course, the world looks at it, even with its progression to what it is today, as somewhat harmless and as, you know, good, clean fun. Even the things that are no longer good and the things that are no longer clean about it. But even the church has a different, and I'm not talking about this church in particular necessarily, but the church throughout our culture has different attitudes about Halloween, has different perspectives. And I'm going to divide those perspectives into two basic approaches. And these are fairly typical, I think. The first approach is that some churches fully participate in Halloween. And they participate in it as Halloween. Meaning that there are churches that will have special events tonight. There are churches in this valley that will have special events that are actually Halloween events, in which there are certain limits that are set by the church as far as, you know, these kind of costumes are allowed and these other kind of costumes aren't allowed, but they bring the people together and the kids together, and they celebrate Halloween within certain boundaries. Now, I just heard on the radio this week there was a survey done of the average person in the street, and they asked them, do you see any conflict between celebrating Halloween and your religious convictions? Because we know that in past surveys that the vast majority of people in our country consider themselves to be born-again Christians. Now, it's not true that the vast majority of people are born-again Christians, but that's what the way people prefer to see themselves and prefer to look at their own lives and their own relationship with God. And so out of those people that were surveyed, 90% of the people that were asked, do you see any conflict between celebrating Halloween and in the way that the world typically does and your religious convictions? And 90% said, no, there's no conflict. There's no problem there whatsoever. It's just, like I said, good, clean, harmless fun. And we're talking about even for people that normally attend church and are participating at that level. And I got to thinking, you know, why is that? Well, one, I think it's just a lack of understanding about the background of the event historically. And two, I think in our culture today, even in the church, there is a strong concern that many bear, which is the desire or the fear of appearing too different from the world around us. The concern that if we fail to participate at some level, either we're going to look a little strange or our kids are going to look a little strange and we're going to have to explain ourselves to everybody and it's just too much trouble and it's too much involved in all that. So why don't we just go ahead and participate at some level anyway and we'll just kind of try and set boundaries around our participation. Now, the other approach that Christians tend to take is one of complete and total avoidance of the holiday altogether. How many of you have ever had this experience? It's Halloween night, like tonight. and it's about, what time is the sun going to go down tonight? 5:30. Okay. It's now 5:30, 6 o'clock, and here is a family of believers sitting in their house. The lights are out. They're on purpose going to extremes to not make any noise, because in a few minutes the trick-or-treaters are going to come hitting the door, and if we don't turn on any lights and if we don't make any noise, maybe they'll just go away and we won't have to deal with it. Well, you may have tried, I don't know what your response to Halloween has been, and you may have tried a number of different things. I know Sandy and I have, from you know, either greeting people at the door and giving them candy and just letting their holiday pass at that level, or attempting to actually use it as an opportunity to witness to someone, or we've at times just left the house and gone to see a movie that night, not Halloween part, whatever. you know, so, and then there are, you know, like this afternoon we're going to go with some friends to a harvest festival, which is, you know, one of the churches in the area sponsoring this festival, which is kind of evacuated of all of its Halloween connotations other than sharing the same day on the calendar. And it's just going to be, you know, like a celebration time so that the Christians have some alternative. Well, all of those things are fine, and I don't have a problem with any of them. In fact, like I said at the beginning, I personally won't have a problem or an issue if you decide to participate. As long as you participate, and I'm talking about in Halloween as the world sees it, as long as you participate with understanding and with knowledge of what it is you're doing and why you're doing it. So let me talk to you for a few minutes about the history of this event. How many of you at least one time since you become a Christian have heard something of the history of Halloween before? Okay, so almost everybody. And so I'm going to share some things with you that you've heard some of these things before, and some of them you may not have heard before. But the reason for doing that is that in any event that the entire culture pays attention to, the entire society and world around us makes a point of stopping and changing the way that they act and the way that they think and the way that they behave during that period of time, I think it's important for us to have some spiritual understanding of what it is that is at the root of all of that, so that we can make, as I said, better informed decisions and a more discerning decision in regards to our level of participation or avoidance. When I started to, I've read some different things on Halloween's history before, but I had never personally done an in-depth search to find out what really lies at the root of this thing. And I discovered some interesting stuff that I didn't know before. And it was kind of what I found as I was kind of sifting through conflicting reports. And that is because we're dealing with ancient history, history that goes back to, you know, by all accounts, you know, just a few short hundred years past the time of Jesus. It goes back into ancient history. And anytime you get far enough back in history, you run the risk of coming across conflicting reports of what happened then and why a certain thing developed the way that it developed. And that's because of this. History is a tool. And it is, as a tool, it's a tool of knowledge and a tool of understanding, but as a tool, it can be used properly and it can be abused. And to abuse history is to take facts and to manipulate them, add to them, tweak them a little bit because you have an agenda of something that you're trying to accomplish by a retelling of history that more suits the goal of what you're wanting to accomplish. And unfortunately, even some good-hearted Christian people have taken the history of Halloween and kind of abused it in order to try and accomplish what they believed was a good goal, which was to eliminate Halloween and the observance of Halloween altogether, at least among the Christians, among the churches. And what I discovered is that there has been some sensationalizing of Halloween's history. How many of you have ever run across a comic book or a tract produced by a man named Jack Chick? Chick Tracts or comic books? A few of you, not that many. Jack Chick was, I think he's still alive. He's a Christian cartoonist, very well known at the time that I first came to know the Lord. And those comic books and those tracts were big in circulation among the Christians that I first grew up in the Lord with. And you can still go into the Christian bookstore and find his materials. But he did a big focus on Halloween. And my first exposure to the history of Halloween was reading Jack Chick's tracts and comic books. And his history basically goes along these lines. that Halloween started back in ancient Celtic history with the Druids, and the Druids on this particular night would dress up in their long dark hooded robes, and they would visit from castle to castle in ancient medieval England and Ireland and Scotland, and they would knock on the castle doors in order to demand a young virgin be given to them so that they could take her out and sacrifice her to their god, their lord of the dead, by the name of Samhain. And that if the castle responded properly, they would leave behind a jack-o'-lantern, which was supposed to be fueled by baby's fat. Okay? Now that's the jack chick version of the origins of Halloween. And you can go into any Christian bookstore today and find that. Well, not any Christian bookstore. The more discerning Christian bookstores won't carry it. But you can find it in many Christian bookstores, and that is a version that is very popular among Christians who address the issues of Halloween. The only problem with that is that none of that is true or accurate historically. It sounds fascinating and horrifying, and it creates, as I probably created in you, as I just briefly described that, somewhat of a revulsion to that activity. And if that really had happened, we should have that same kind of reaction. But if none of that happened, and the history of it was something entirely different, then what we would be doing with good intentions is reacting to something that's not real. We'd be reacting to Jack Chick's imagination rather than history. And so that's what I mean by history being either used properly or abused with an agenda. Now, the reality of it is that Halloween does come from ancient Celtic history, and it is important to understand that. I'm going to talk for a minute about that, but I want you to understand right up front, I'm not anti-Celtic, okay? I like Celtic things. I almost went with my wife last weekend with the Moors to the Celtic festival down in Orange County. We would have gone down there if we had been able to and enjoyed ourselves and had a good time. I love Celtic music. The Chieftains, who are a Celtic band, happen to be one of my favorite bands to listen to. I love their music. I like River Dance and all the, you know, the flashing feet and all that kind of stuff. So I just want you to understand right up front, anything I say about the Celts is not anything to do directly with I'm against the Celts or against that people. I love, and all of those things I'm talking about, the dancing and the music and stuff, that all comes from ancient, it develops from ancient Celtic history. So there are good things about that, but there are some things that we need to be aware of, okay? So what is the difference between the fact and the legend? Well, like the Druid blood sacrifices on Halloween night, for instance, there was a group that were known as the Druids, and they were sort of the priestly caste or the priestly group among the Celtic peoples, and they were not Christian, and they were living their lives based upon a wrong view of God and of life, and teaching the peoples and leading the peoples in religious principles that were not compatible with the gospel. But there is absolutely no history that indicates that the Druids ever practiced human sacrifice, ever. They were, in one sense, something that I would not recommend any of us ever listening to or following their example, but they're not the ogres that they're made out to be in some of the sensational accounts. They were not going around from castle to castle looking for people to sacrifice. And in terms of like the idea of them leaving behind a jack-o'-lantern, back in those days in England and in Scotland and Ireland, they didn't even have pumpkins. Where did pumpkins come from? Pumpkins came from here. It wasn't until the Pilgrims came over here years later that they discovered pumpkins when the Indians, the American Indians, turned the Pilgrims on to pumpkins and their benefits. So the whole idea of ancient Druids leaving pumpkins at the castle door is just pretty far-fetched. Now what they did do, and this is, you know, this is where there's some historical reality to this, is they took large turnips. Big turnips. They would grow these big turnips, and then they would cut the top of the turnip off and hollow out a turnip. And they would carve faces into the turnips, and they would carve faces of skeletons into the turnips. So why would they do that? Well, the ancient holiday that later developed in history to what is now Halloween was a Celtic holiday, and it was a holiday called Samhain, which probably is they say better pronounced using the Gaelic accent, something like Samhain rather than Samhain. But you'll see it spelled Samhain in the literature, and so that's how I'm going to pronounce it, because I'm not Gaelic, and neither are you. But anyway, Samhain literally meant summer's end. Okay, it was nothing dramatic or dark or devious like, you'll see Samhain is commonly referred to as the Lord of the Dead or the god of the Celts. But there's no indication in the historical literature that Samhain was worshipped as a god. It was a day, a holiday celebration, which indicated summer was coming to an end and winter was upon the people. It was time for winter. And it was a harvest festival. It was in recognition of the summer's harvest coming to a conclusion. And winter was about to come. And because they were an agricultural people, and because harvest was a critical time, they viewed this Samhain day as a transition day from one period of the year to another, and it was called the time between times, in that it was a single day that was kind of not exactly summer and not exactly winter. And because it was this transitional time, they believed that all of the ancestors that had gone before them, the people who had died, now had an opportunity to come back and visit them. So it was the day in which the doorway in their worldview, the doorway between this world and the next world, was thrown open for this day. And there was an opportunity for those who had passed on to come back and visit them. And there was an opportunity even for them to pass beyond that door temporarily and visit people who had passed on into the other side. And so what they would do on this day, among other things, is they would celebrate it as an ancestral day in which they would actually not only, it was like in the common modern day mythology of Halloween, it's kind of portrayed as a day to be afraid of the dead. But for the Celts, it was a day to actually invite their ancestors to come and celebrate the harvest with them. And so they would do all of these various rituals in hopes of encouraging one of their departed ancestors to come and spend the evening with them. Because while Samhain was actually on November 1st, they would celebrate it starting sundown on October 31st. And very similar to how the Jewish people celebrate their holidays. It would start on the evening of the day before. And so they would invite these spirits to come and celebrate with them. Now, we know from biblical understanding that it is not possible for the spirits of departed ancestors to come and visit us, because they've passed over into another realm and God sets limits and boundaries around their activity, and they're assigned to one location or another. So if they were inviting spirits to come, what spirits were they actually really inviting to come and participate with them in their worship? Well, demonic spirits, because that's the only other option. Now, these people weren't doing that knowingly, consciously saying to themselves, hey, let's have a celebration, and I got a good idea. Let's invite all the demons to come and spend the evening with us. What they were thinking they were doing is having their dearly departed loved ones come and share this celebration with them in hopes that the ancestors, once they arrived, would bless the coming year and would guide them for the coming year. But of course, any of those households that successfully managed to invite a spirit to come and celebrate with them actually received a demonic spirit. Now, obviously, demonic spirits, as we know from the scriptures, are able to transform themselves and to masquerade, disguise themselves as spirits of light rather than darkness. And so there was probably a lot of interaction with spirits from the beyond, but not, of course, with the ancestors. And so that's when some of the mischief that we normally associate with Halloween really started to develop. As these spirits would come, they would then start to do things in the household, in the farms, and in the communities of the people that were inviting these spirits. And not only that, but the people that participated in it kind of got into the spirit of things, so to speak, and it was not uncommon, just like it's not uncommon for our culture, for the younger men in the community to go out and to actually on purpose do mischief. And what they did, though, was they would do things like, the young men in the community, the boys in the community would get together, and they would go out on that evening, and they would do things like taking one farmer's farm animals and moving them to another farmer's farm. Just for what reason? Well, just to do some mischief and also to convince the farmers that the spirits had actually come and had actually arrived and were obviously present because of the changes in the activities that they saw around them. So they did all kinds of things of mischief like that. But in order to go out safely, what the young men did was they practiced what was called guising, which we would call disguising themselves, in that they would dress up and they would put on masks, because when they went out into the community, they felt they were safe as long as they were within their own homes. But when they went out into the community, they were fair targets for any of the departed spirits that had come. And when the departed spirits came, they weren't always happy, because maybe there was some problems in the family before they departed, and they were looking to get even with someone in particular. At least this is what they thought, right? And so as they would go out, they disguised themselves because they didn't want to be recognized for who they actually were. They wanted the spirits to see their disguise and not recognize them and then pass on and leave them alone. So that's where the whole idea of costuming all originated. Now that, eventually, you carry that forward in history, and in 1960, I'm dressing up as Superman. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, why did I dress up as Superman? I had no clue. I had no idea that that's where that practice, that tradition, that activity originated from. And it didn't matter to me when I was 5 years old. But now that I'm 44 years old, it matters to me. And I can guarantee you, you won't see me in red trunks running around the community this evening. I will be out and about, but I will be in my plain clothes approach, okay? Other things that were involved, some of the things, and I won't go into too many of them because there's just there's so much detail connected to this, but like one of the most popular things to do on Halloween is bobbing for apples, right? How many of you ever actually bobbed for an apple? Okay, most of us have done that, okay? Hopefully a demon didn't jump inside of you when you did this, but the practice of bobbing for apples was a Celtic practice, and it was a means of divination. Now, divination, biblically, is categorized as an evil thing. It's categorized as something that we should never practice as Christians. Divination is the attempt, the desire and the attempt, to foresee the future through means that God has not appointed for our lives. And cultures all through history and even up to this present day commonly practice all kinds of different divination practices because people are fascinated with the possibility of their future life. And, you know, we get a certain sense, falsely so, but a certain sense of comfort and security if we can know in our own minds what's coming down the road. And so bobbing for apples was a divination practice in which on Halloween evening they would commonly put a tub of water out and put apples in it like we do. And when someone, and they would have the young people bob for apples, and when the young person actually got an apple in their mouth and their head came back up out of the water, the belief was that they would hear in their inner ear the name spoken or whispered of their future husband or bride. And that was a means of determining the future of their life and their marriage. Okay? Now, that's where bobbing for apples came from. Now, is it possible that you can today, as a Christian, bob for apples and do it without, really overstepping some major spiritual boundaries with the Lord? I think it is possible, but at the same time, I would recommend that you do it with understanding of what you're doing, meaning that you need to know before you make the decision to dunk your head in the water the first time that the first person that ever did this or taught someone else to do it was doing it out of a heart and a desire to practice divination. So for myself, I choose not to bob for apples. Number one, I'm already married. Number two, I don't think that it's something that's ultimately pleasing to the Lord. Okay? Does that mean that if I catch wind that any of you are bobbing for apples tonight, that, you know, next week you're going to be getting a call from me and, you know, there's a threat of church discipline or something like that? No, no. I don't have a problem if you do it. I just would like you to do it with understanding and knowledge of what it is you're doing, because I'm confident that if you did it, you would be doing just the physical part of it without the spiritual meaning attached. For instance, I know that there are believers, some probably even in this congregation, who practice yoga and are able to do that. Well, what's the origin of yoga? Yoga is not a good thing if you look back in the history of yoga. Yoga, the whole physical practice of yoga is an expression of worship to false gods. But is it possible to separate the worship aspect of yoga from the physical benefits of yoga and still practice it as an exercise? It is possible, but you need to know what you're doing and you need to have understanding. Same with karate. Karate was originally something completely different than what most Christians use it for in terms of physical exercise and self-defense and those kind of things. So again, my concern is not just to talk you out of bobbing for apples. My concern is to help you to understand what you're doing and to equip you to discern what you're doing. Now, I have said at the beginning that Halloween is a Christian holiday. And what did I mean by that? And if it is, should we therefore then practice it as a holiday? Well, since this holiday, this Celtic holiday of Samhain, was just that, we get the word holiday from what? Holy day. Meaning it's a day of worship. That's what a holy day is. We know in one sense, biblically, that all days are holy because God has created all days and He rules over all days. But we set aside, and cultures have always done this, certain days, and we identify them or label them as holy days. But other cultures have done this also. Cultures that don't believe in the gospel and don't believe in Jesus. And the holiday of Samhain was a Celtic holy worship day. All right. Now, what happened then was in history when the gospel penetrated the Celtic culture. When the gospel first came to Ireland, when it first came to England, and when it first came to Scotland. The gospel, as it does, when it impacts every culture, eventually overwhelmed the pagan beliefs and practices of the peoples that were living there. Because the gospel is more powerful than any belief system, than any of the peoples of this world hold to. And so the gospel ultimately overwhelms and overpowers those belief systems. It did that with the Celts. The problem was, and this often happens, if you read anything about missionary activity and what happens when the gospel first comes to a people that have never heard of it before, it's difficult at times for peoples that are first embracing this new message about Jesus and about God and about the cross and about the resurrection. It's difficult at times for peoples to let go of all of their former worship practices. It's even difficult at times for us as believers to do that. But what happened for the Celts was that as the gospel penetrated their culture, they did embrace it. And the Celts, for the most part, as a cultural people, became Christian. And as they became Christian, and it came to November 1st for the first time of the year after the gospel first penetrated, did they readily and quickly recognize, well, we can't do this stuff anymore because we're Christians now. The implications of what we're doing, it just doesn't fit. It doesn't link together with this new understanding and these new principles and this new belief that God has brought into our life. No, they didn't do it that way. What they did was they held to their belief in Jesus and held on to their celebration of Samhain. They refused to let it go. So what did the leaders of the church do? That's the question. What did the leaders of the church do? They had a couple of choices. They could have drawn a line and put their foot down and said, if you new believers, you new Celtic converts, are going to fully embrace the gospel, you've got to let go of these former pagan worship practices of yours. You've got to let them go. And if you don't, you can't be part of the gospel and the Christian community as we go forward. And as the gospel continues its forward expansion. That was one option. The other option was, well, as long as they really believe in Jesus with all their hearts, and as long as they embrace the gospel, it's not going to hurt too much if we let them hold on to a few of the things from their former life and their former cultural practices. It's just somewhat harmless, good, clean fun. And so what the Christian church leaders did was they inventively baptized the celebration of Samhain and transformed it by attaching a new label to it. And instead of Samhain, it now became what you've all probably heard of, which was All Saints Day. And that was a Christian decision to do that by the leaders of the church at that time. And what they did was they said, instead of honoring and inviting the departed ancestors in order to seek their blessing and in order to seek their guidance for the new year, what we will do instead is we will honor and invite the blessing of the saints who have passed before us. all of the great figures of early Christian history, and we will speak about them, and we will recount their stories, and we will ask them to intercede for us and pray for us to bless our new years. Now, all of that was done, I think, with somewhat good motivation. But I think it was a really, really bad decision on the part of the church leaders at that time. Because what resulted then was kind of a conglomeration, a mixture of something that was partly biblical and something that was a lot not biblical. And that developed then into what we call Halloween, because All Saints' Day was All Hallows' Day. Hallow mean like we talk about the Lord hallowing His name in the Lord's Prayer. It meant to make something holy. So All Hallows' Day was All Saints' or All Holies' Day, the Holy People's Day. And so the evening before was Halloween, because it was a contraction of All Hallows' Evening, the evening before. And that became then a early Christian holiday. So when I say that Halloween is a Christian holiday, I'm speaking absolutely truth. It's a Christian holiday. But that, just because it is, does that mean we should participate at that level that they did in the early church and respond to it in the same way that they did in the early church? And I would say that's for each one of us to discern. My own decision, my own choice, is to not participate at that level, because I don't think it should have ever been a Christian holiday. I don't think the church is called to take pagan holidays and rebaptize them and to kind of dress them up in nicer external clothing in hopes that maybe this will be an adequate substitute for what they did in their former worship practices. I don't think Paul the Apostle did those kind of things, because he commonly ran across, in bringing the gospel to new cultures and new people groups, he constantly ran across cultural practices and had many opportunities to do that very thing, where the people that were being saved were being brought out of former worship practices. But instead of doing that, what he would do is he would proclaim the truth and teach the people in hopes that their deeper spiritual understanding would lead them to better choices in the long run. So All Saints' Day, or All Hallows' Evening, then became, in the 1500s, and we're fast-forwarding some time forward, it had another name attached to it, which was in 1530, on November 1st, Martin Luther, who was a Catholic priest, who was very concerned with the spiritual condition and the compromise that he saw in the Catholic Church, chose, on purpose, intentionally, he strategized and chose All Saints' Day to make his bold proclamation by nailing his 95 complaints about the Catholic Church on the Wittenberg door. And that started what is known in history as the Reformation. And those groups that followed Martin Luther's example and learned from his example and entered into the Reformation as a church then began to commemorate that special day that Martin Luther did that, and renamed All Saints' Day as Reformation Day. And there are many, many hundreds and thousands of Reformed churches throughout the world today that celebrate Reformation Day because of what Martin Luther did. Do I have a problem if you celebrate Reformation Day? No, I think it's wonderful. I am a big fan of the Reformation. I think it's a really good thing that happened. And a lot of my doctrinal understanding of God's Word is a direct result of reading some of the Reformers' writings and teachings, and I'll be forever grateful to the Lord for the things I've learned from them. Do I personally celebrate Reformation Day? There was a sister in the church a few years ago who really wanted us as a church to make a point of celebrating Reformation Day. You probably noticed, but so far we haven't had a Reformation Day celebration. Are we doing that today? No. Do we have a special event tonight? No. Why? I believe that all of those things, including Reformation Day, can be a good attempt at changing something bad into something good. But I also believe this, that Jesus taught this, that if the root of the tree is bad, the tree is bad. If the root of the tree is good, the tree is good. And the only way you can really tell is by the fruit that it ultimately produces, but the root of the tree is what ultimately matters in the quality of the fruit that's produced. And the way I look at it is that has some application in history. So I believe that looking back at the root of this holiday, there is enough about the original celebration, the Celtic holiday, the holy day of the Celts, that concerns me, that bothers me, that is unbiblical, that does not take into account the truth of God's Word, does not take into account the Gospel. And so I personally choose not to participate at that level. Will I be home alone tonight with my wife and sitting in a dark house hoping that the trick-or-treaters go away? No. Like I said, I'm going out tonight. But last year, we stayed in our house. We had the lights on. I went out and bought, it must have been, 25 pounds of those Smarties, the little individual candies in a roll. And when people rang my doorbell, I handed them out. So it's not like I'm against that. And plus, I'm still eating last year's Smarties. So, there's like kind of a double benefit there. But what I want us to see is that we're called not to accommodate the culture around us. We're called, I believe, to confront the culture around us. Now, there's a wise way to confront someone, and there's an unwise way to confront someone. I'll never forget, I was meeting with a pastor friend of mine a few years ago. He has a ministry where he proclaims the gospel in public on Hollywood Boulevard, and I've had some experience doing that with him. But we were eating dinner one night when we were going out to minister the gospel, and we were eating at a restaurant there on Hollywood Boulevard. And there's a lot of Christians that do ministry on Hollywood Boulevard because it's such a spiritually dark and perverted place. And we were eating dinner in this restaurant, having a nice quiet dinner, talking about our strategy for the night to come. And walking into this restaurant was a good-hearted, I think, well-intentioned young believer who had his own unique witnessing style. And his witnessing style was he walked in the front door of the restaurant, and at the top of his lungs, he shouted this to everybody in the restaurant, "Jesus loves you!" And then he turned around and walked out. Now, that was a young man that was confronting the culture. Right? And who knows? God knows. Maybe someone got saved by that confrontation. Maybe God used that to penetrate one person's heart in that restaurant. But I'll tell you, the vast majority of the people in that restaurant had a different kind of reaction, including my friend and I, who were both Christians. And so there's a wise way to confront and an unwise way to confront. But I think those are really our only two options when it comes to something like Halloween. In that, let me read you the dictionary definitions of those two terms. To accommodate means to adapt to adjust to bend yourself to fit something, and to conform to something. Whereas to confront means to meet face to face, to encounter, and to issue a challenge. And when we are looking at something that the entire culture pays attention to, like Halloween, I think we need to pay attention to our biblical calling. Let me read you just a couple of passages of Scripture and we'll end here today. The first one is in Romans chapter 12, a passage that you're well familiar with. But the first two verses of Romans chapter 12 say this: "Therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship." The implication of Paul's statement there in verse 1 is that everything we do, when we do it with a right perspective, a right understanding of God's calling in our life and God's place in our life, everything we do is worship. Everything. Everything is worship. It's our spiritual service of worship. Anything we do with our body becomes worship if we do it as unto the Lord. And he adds this to it: do not be conformed to this world, but, in contrast, be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. Let me read you one of the phrases from verse 2 from the New Living Translation. It's phrased this way: don't copy the behavior and the customs of this world. Don't be conformed to this world. Instead, be transformed. So there are behavior patterns, and there are customs that the world around us just commonly celebrates or focuses on or pays attention to or values. Halloween is just one of those things. This is not that different from Christmas. We do the same thing for Christmas. I'm not about to launch into a whole history of Christmas here, but most of you may know this, some of you may not. But Christmas originally, if you trace it far enough back, is what? Yes, somebody knows it. It's a pagan holiday, Saturnalia, December 25th. The church did the same exact thing with Christmas that it did with Halloween, which is when the people were unwilling at the beginning to let go, the Roman people were unwilling to let go of their practice of Saturnalia on December 25th, the church said, okay, I'll tell you what, let's just do this, let's change the name, and refocus the attention. And it became the birth of Jesus. Now, we know Jesus was really born. That's not the issue. The issue is when he was born and why they chose December 25th. Now, am I going to tell you then, with Christmas coming up, don't celebrate Christmas? No, I'm not going to tell you that. I celebrate Christmas. I'm glad for Christmas. It's a wonderful time of the year. The difference, though, between Halloween and Christmas is this. Christmas has almost totally, historically, overwhelmed, because Christmas is Christ Mass originally. It has almost totally overwhelmed the memory of Saturnalia. In that, even in secular cultural understanding of December 25th, when it comes that time of year, nobody sits around and thinks about the historical backgrounds of Saturnalia. I mean, some of you have never even heard of that before. That's a case where the gospel and the church's choice to replace one thing with another has completely overwhelmed the pagan practices and memories of the past. And I think that's a good thing. I have no problem with that. Halloween is a different issue. There's still a mixture going on, even though the church has attempted, historically, going back to the Middle Ages, to replace one with the other. It's only been, even to this present day, a partial replacement, partially successful, in that there's still a common linking to those historical roots and even the more perverted things that have been added to it or sprinkled into it in our more modern culture. And the other passage of Scripture I'd like to read to you to go with this is from the Gospel of John, and we'll end here today. Gospel of John, this is in chapter 17, the Lord Jesus' prayer for His disciples. I'm not going to read the entire prayer, just a short section of it. And this thing that Jesus is praying here for His disciples really highlights our responsibility as disciples of the Lord, in that we know, as disciples of the Lord, that we commonly wrestle with issues of living in this world, and yet how can we live in this world and yet not really mimic and be just exactly like the people that are in the world, which would mean we would be of the world. And Jesus prays for this very issue for us. Not just His disciples. He prays. He says later in the prayer, He's praying this for everyone that would ever come to believe in Him. And so we're confident that Jesus was praying this for every one of our hearts. And if He prayed it, did He get an answer to His prayer? Does God answer Jesus' prayer? He absolutely is still, Father God is still committed to answering this thing that Jesus prayed for us. Okay? So let's read from John 17. I'll read verses 13 through 19 only.
The copyrighted product of Tree of Life Christian Church of Canoga Park, California. You are welcome to pass this message along to others as long as it is not sold and it is passed along unaltered in its entirety with source credit given to Tree of Life Christian Church.